Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Michael Moran in New York.
And from London, I'm Charles Hecker. In this special edition of the Risk Map Podcast, we'll be grappling again with one of the key lessons of the 21st century, that risk exists not only in the developing world, but in the developed world too. We learned that lesson in 2008 when the balance sheets of banks, corporations, and sovereigns as well turned out to be a lot less healthy than anyone thought.
Well, and then fast forward to today, and we have political risk absolutely radiating from Europe and the United States. The stunning electoral victory of Republican Donald Trump, only the most recent example. So in this special edition, we go around the world and harvest the knowledge of our colleagues abroad in search of the risks and opportunities posed by the Trump presidency. And with that, I'll start as the U.S. analyst. The election, Chuck, was an expression of populism that has been suppressed by the two-party system for years. The Democratic Party in the United States for a long time had turned its back on free trade, and yet presidents elected by the Democrats had signed free trade accords. Bill Clinton in the 90s with the North American Free Trade Agreement, and Barack Obama was poised to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership through a somewhat reluctant Congress at the end of his term. Now we see that landscape remade by a Republican, normally the party of free trade, that is against free trade and has won over that Democratic faction and won election as president. It's stunning, and it's going to change the landscape in many ways. So early moves from the Trump presidency that we divine, there will be some very quick moves to deregulate energy and mining. These were things done over the head of Congress and over their objections by President Barack Obama with executive powers, and those powers will now transfer to Donald Trump, and he will reverse those actions, and that will deregulate areas of those industries. There will be tax cuts and fiscal cuts. The Republicans also maintained their hold of Congress. They are negotiating very hard on how to formulate those tax and fiscal cuts, but there will be some form of tax cut stimulus, and looks as though they're going to possibly work with Democrats to pass some bills that would pump up infrastructure spending as well. That might actually run into problems with the Republican Congress, which tends to be much more concerned about deficits and the national debt. On trade, of course, famously, Donald Trump, during his candidacy, has promised to pull out of the North American Free Trade Agreement, something that Mexico is dealing with in global markets right now, and it's a very difficult situation for Mexico. China had been focused upon in the campaign as the source of globalized flow of American jobs abroad. You can expect some early moves to put tariffs on things like Chinese steel and aluminum. And if the candidate Trump rhetoric is to translate into policy, it's going to go beyond those segments and probably include things like auto parts and selected electronics components. That does raise the question of retaliation. We'll get that into that later. And then in foreign policy, we'll see a stepped-up metabolism of U.S. operations against the Islamic State. There has been talk in the campaign of ripping up the Iran nuclear accord. We believe that will be done somewhat differently. There'll be pressure put on it, not necessarily a rescission. It's a complex issue. We'll also talk about that a bit later. The Paris Climate Accord, I think the Trump administration intends to pull out of it. That's a very complicated thing. And, of course, he has promised to put pressure on both NATO and the U.S. Asian allies to put more money into their own defense. So the other big picture foreign policy issue that has been prominent in the campaign has been the hope for a reset once again with Russia. Vladimir Putin and Trump have already spoken, Chuck. The contents of their conversation is not well known, but the fact that they spoke so early confirmed the idea that Donald Trump intends to try to reset that relationship and make it more productive. So, Chuck, what is possible there? What opportunities flow from that, and what are the dangers?
Mike, thanks. The attitude of the impending Trump presidency towards Russia has us initially trying very hard to analyze the potential differences between campaign rhetoric and then what happens when a candidate begins to govern. And so you'll recall during the campaign, candidate Trump was praising President Putin for his strength as a leader and said that he was somebody that he thought he could do business with. And this, we thought, reflected candidate Trump's transactional approach to working with Russia and maybe a transactional and more business-like approach to foreign affairs in general. So one of the very first phone calls that he had with a foreign leader was with President Putin. That call went well. Both leaders acknowledged that U.S.-Russian relations are in a fairly deplorable state. They have stated the obvious on that. And both vowed to work towards improving the relationship. And President Putin, in fact, came out of that conversation and stated publicly that the two individuals exchanged a promise not to interfere in each other's domestic affairs. And that's something that the Russians have always wanted to hear from the United States. We'll see if that promise was actually extended by President-elect Trump, and if it was, how long it lasts. The interesting thing here is that as a candidate transitions to someone who governs, reality begins to bite. And as President-elect Trump is beginning to select his potential secretaries of state, some of those candidates have made public statements recently that are diametrically opposed to Trump's position on Russia. You've heard a lot of very Cold War drum banging, for example, from Rudy Giuliani, who's mentioned as one of the top candidates for the State Department, saying that Russia is a hostile state, it's an aggressor state, and we need to deal with it from a position of strength. So we'll see what happens when President-elect Trump appoints a Secretary of State. That's a major move towards some sort of clarity, some sort of directionality in foreign relations, particularly in the relationship with Russia. I think what you'll see, though, in the immediate future, at least from the White House, is you'll see a lot of the rhetoric come out of the dialogue with the Kremlin. You will no longer hear anyone in the White House, at least, campaigning against Russia's record on human rights or talking about Russia's behavior in other parts of the world. A lot of the Russia bashing will come out of the Washington-Moscow dialogue. That itself may be a step in the right direction. The next few steps are extremely complicated, and that's going to be working out a relationship in Syria. Trump says that he's going to cooperate with Russia on a series of initiatives, including counterterrorism. We've seen that happen before. We've seen discrete, specific counter-initiatives launched and then lapse. And I'm not convinced yet that working on specific subtopics will breed a broader, more cooperative relationship between Moscow and Washington in general. But we'll see. The two countries still have very different agendas in Syria beyond anti-terrorism, and that will probably be the first big test of the U.S.-Russian relationship. Finally, we'll see where President Trump, after January 20th, makes his first foreign trip. And that's something that White House watchers love to pay attention to. You know, where is Air Force One going to go the first time it makes a foreign trip? If it's Russia, that'll be a very big signal.
Thanks, Chuck. So let's pivot over to China, which, as I said, was a real focus of the campaign, mostly a negative focus from the Trump campaign. There are some very early signals that the relationship with China is going to be in the crosshairs early. There are already, as I said, potential tariffs waiting for Chinese aluminum and steel products. So those things are likely to happen. The extent to which they will now lead to a more general making good on Donald Trump's candidacy claims that he was going to put a 45% tariff on Chinese goods incoming to the United States, it remains to be seen. That's a pretty tricky proposition. In conversations with my colleagues in Shanghai and Beijing, we have generally thought that it probably won't be that much of a giant sledgehammer approach, but that even something just beyond very specific tariffs could really create pressure on the Chinese government to retaliate. Today now, we have a situation where China essentially exports about five times more to the United States than the United States exports to China. Donald Trump would like to see that more in balance, but that does give the United States a great deal of leverage in these kind of early moves as it seeks to try to get China to change the terms of trade. So what we're concerned about is that if this doesn't take the form of a conversation and it takes the form of step-by-step tariffs on other areas of Chinese exports or very kind of aggressive moves in the World Trade Organization to sanction China for its state subsidies of certain industries, that China will feel under pressure to react. There are things China could do. They would target probably U.S. agricultural imports. They could make the supply chains of, for instance, the technology industry very complicated. We remember a standoff with Japan several years ago where rare earths, which is a mineral used in electronics and sourced almost entirely from China, were basically taken off the market by China, and it caused quite a bit of pain in the technology industry. So China, too, has things to do. We don't believe it's going to get so bad that we could call it a trade war, but there is going to be a bit of friction over trade with China, and that is going to have a knock-on effect geopolitically, too, because China has, in many ways, put itself in opposition to a lot of what the West represents right now in Asia. It has been a way of expanding its own influence. It has, for instance, recently, at least from all indications, kind of picked off the Philippines. The new president of the Philippines does now align himself, at least rhetorically, with China. So these kind of rivalries in the past have been kept under wraps by the fact that there was so much to lose in the economic relationship. If that economic relationship now is a source of friction rather than a source of mutual consent, that means that these smaller rivalries and these little incidents that may pop up in places like the South China Sea or over a dissident, these things can get out of hand much more easily, and that's not good for stability generally. Of course, it's not just the United States that's radiating risk these days. This, in many ways, you could argue, has started with the trend that we saw in Europe with the Brexit vote. Chuck, give us a sense of how this is going to play out in Europe and whether we see an echo of this election.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Thanks, Mike. In no particular order, yeah, let's start with Brexit. You know, a bit of a bomb really went off here in the United Kingdom, at least, when the first British person President-elect Trump met with was Nigel Farage, who, of course, was one of the key figures in leading the UK out of the European Union, or at least in leading the campaign to vote against membership in the European Union. And so, you know, that really resonated, not necessarily in a very popular way here in the UK, and set off a very interesting tone. Moreover, President-elect Trump has recently spoken with British Prime Minister Theresa May, and apparently closed their conversation by saying, listen, next time you're in the US, let me know. And that was also a statement from President-elect Trump that clanged a bit here in the UK. So we really don't know what the President Trump's view will be on Brexit. There's a chance that the US and the UK could fast track a free trade agreement and show the world that they can both do this very quickly. That would be very much in the interest of the UK, but we're really not sure there's enough momentum or enough political will on either side, or frankly, the political capacity on the British side to get that going. So Brexit is very, very much a wait and see as far as the US is concerned, because quite frankly, Brexit is still very much wait and see as far as any action is concerned on the Brexit front. I think the really burning issue for Europe with a Trump presidency has got to be NATO. And you know that during the campaign, candidate Trump made a lot of highly critical remarks about NATO that called into question the mutual defense article of the NATO treaty and brought down sharp criticism, particularly on the Baltic states, for countries that are not paying their fair share, their 2% of GDP, on military equipment. And so there's a little bit of nerves here about whether the United States is going to be a reliable NATO partner. But once again, when you switch from campaign rhetoric to governing, reality again starts to bite, and it's going to bite hard here, because even though the U.S. is clearly the dominant member of NATO, there are 28 nations in the Northern Atlantic Treaty Organization, and each of them is going to have a word on this. And I think it will be difficult for the United States to unilaterally disable NATO or to hobble NATO. And I think that when the 27 other members make their feelings known about how NATO works and the condition of certain states who aren't at the moment spending their fair share of GDP on weapons, I think that the Trump stance on NATO will soften. The United States is going to have to remind the rest of the organization that it will defend them in the event of an invasion. Just to put everybody at ease, under no scenario does Control Risk see a Russian invasion of the Baltics or of any other part of NATO.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, as we end with Europe and move to the Middle East, let's look at the flow of refugees, which has really played a role in the surging populist vote counts that we're seeing in Europe. We have some important elections coming up in France, in Germany, and in the Netherlands. And of course, next month we have a referendum in Italy over governance, all of which are seen as signposts for the extent to which populist parties are muscling the kind of center-right, center-left parties out of positions of power in Europe. The refugee flows, of course, while they come from conflict zones all over the world, have really of late been mostly concentrated out of Syria and its war. I mean, this is hopefully one of the places where a reset in U.S.-Russian relations, we believe, might actually bring some progress. Chuck, as you said, there are so many conflicting agendas there, Turkey, Russia, the United States, and NATO, that there is a hope that the question of whether, for instance, Bashar Assad's regime survives any kind of a peace in Syria is something that now the U.S. and Russia can speak more forthrightly on. There is a sense here that the Trump administration is not as committed to removing Mr. Assad or in holding him up to any kind of international court of justice, which, whatever you think of it, has been a major impediment to having some kind of an agreement on the ground between the U.S. and Russia. So we see that there may be some scope for a deal between Russia. In the kind of geopolitical strategist's crazy dreams, there's a deal to be made if you look at the situation in Ukraine and the sanctions that are on Russia, and you look at the situation in Syria and the U.S. interest in focusing on Islamic State. That's the kind of thing that people love to play chess, and people who love to think of themselves as armchair Churchills think that might happen. That's pretty complicated, though. There's a lot of things in the way of that, but it certainly could be something that is broached in these early conversations with the Kremlin. So finally, let's think for a second about Islamic State and what the U.S. is likely to do in that theater. When I said the metabolism of the U.S. operations there will be picking up, I think that's right. I don't think at this point we're looking at what sometimes was floated during the candidacy of Donald Trump, which was almost a de facto reinvasion of Western Iraq with a major U.S. combat unit. That has, to some extent, been changed by facts on the ground. The Iraqi army has made progress, as have the Kurdish militias and others, in surrounding Mosul and in pushing IS toward the brink of being out of Iraq entirely. So the question now becomes, what happens in eastern Syria and around Raqqa, the stronghold of Islamic State? I think the United States would like not to, under Donald Trump, get further involved and entangled overseas. If there's anything he's been clear about, is that he's not interested in extending further U.S. security guarantees or extending further U.S. military operations unless there's an existential threat to the United States. And IS is the one group right now where the United States does seem to glean that kind of a threat. So there will be an uptick in the special operations metabolism over there. There'll be plenty more airstrikes. There'll probably be a very significant push. I would doubt it'll be very public, I think, behind the scenes, to come to terms with Russian, Turkish, and other interests in the region. And this is where it gets complicated, because in the mix, of course, is Iran. Iran and its nuclear accord did not play high in the campaign, but if you look at any of the more important speeches on foreign policy that the candidate gave, ripping up the JCPOA, which is the Diplo speak for the Iran nuclear accord, was high on every list. There's a particular speech that's worth looking at, folks. In Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, in October, there was a laundry list of things that the candidate said he would do in the first 100 days, and I think number three on that list was rip up the Iran nuclear accord. Here, the U.S.-Russia relationship could be significant, because if there are talks to reset the relationship, one would think that the Russians, as a signatory to that accord and a neighbor of Iran, will want to see it survive. We saw recently a big French oil company and the state oil company of China sign an accord for a major oil and gas concession in Iran. So they're putting their cards on a continued existence of that accord. We're likely to see in Congress an effort to ramp up sanctions against Iran, though, at least in areas that don't directly relate to the nuclear accord. So ballistic missile development, its conduct in places like Syria and Yemen, and possibly human rights in Iran. Whether or not that will then include a reimposition of what's called the secondary sanctions, which were the things that made it so difficult for global business to do business in Iran, we just don't know. The honest truth is, The Trump administration has not come into being yet. As Chuck referenced, we don't know who's going to be Secretary of State. There's clearly a bit of a debate going on inside the transition between neoconservatives who feel as though they've won another shot at power to finish unfinished business, and a more pragmatist side that is more alike Donald Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, wants to renegotiate the terms in which the United States engages abroad and push more burden onto allies. That is currently playing out. We don't know the outcome of that and won't until there are certain important posts filled.
Mike, thanks very much. With that, Mike, let's wrap up this special edition of the Risk Map podcast. Join us again in 2 weeks as we get back to our twice monthly look ahead at the issues looming over the global business landscape. Until then, I'm Charles Hecker in London. Thanks very much for tuning in.
And in New York, this is Michael Moran. So long.